friends. Welcome back to the Weekend Interview Show. I'm Scott Horton, your host, and I'm proud to say that the head of one of the local affiliates here in Austin, Texas, just called to say that they agree with me, and they're not running any more of that racist crap on their rebroadcast of this network. I'd like to welcome to my show William Norman Grigg. He's the senior editor of the New American Magazine, the official publication of the John Birch Society. Welcome to the show, sir.
Scott, thank you so much for having me.
Well, I'm sort of sorry to bring you on right in the middle of all that. But
I enjoyed it.
Oh, good. I'm glad to hear that. And in fact, you know, the name John Birch Society, among people who are not too familiar, conjures up images of billboards that say, impeach Earl Warren.
Mm-hmm.
And aren't those Birchers the ones who just wanted to oppose all the civil rights legislation?
The origin of the campaign to impeach Earl Warren was the concern of the founder of the society, Robert Welch, that the Supreme Court had become involved in a rather hypertrophied exercise in judicial activism that was essentially destroying federalism. This was back in the late 1950s and early 1960s. If you take a look at what's happening right now with the growing impasse of the Senate over judicial nominees, and you have both parties with sort of a prehensile grasp on power trying to control the composition of the Supreme Court because they believe that it is the Supreme Court that is in charge of establishing the laws in this country, which, of course, is not the constitutional assignment of powers. But all this was sort of anticipated over 40 years ago by Robert Welch. And what the Warren Court was doing was using a rather torqued perspective on the 14th Amendment as a warrant to increase the power of the federal government to reconfigure states and local communities, abolishing not only laws but settled customs that have nothing to do with constitutional issues, as a way of destroying federalism. And what we were trying to do, and this, of course, took place long before my mortal advent. This is the late 1950s and early 1960s, before I was born. What the John Birch Society was trying to do was focus attention on the fact that the Congress has the power to rein in a renegade court, and if they had done so back then, we would have avoided a lot of trouble that has nothing to do with civil rights, properly understood.
Well, did people who were actually just bigots and wanted to keep the Jim Crow system, did they not latch on to the John Birch constitutional argument as their excuse, kind of?
Not that I'm aware of. Actually, in the 1960s, not only were we saying that we should impeach Earl Warren, but there was a very heroic fellow by the name of Delmar Dennis who was doing his best to expose what the Ku Klux Klan was doing by way of violating the individual rights of black Americans. He was a pastor from Mississippi who had become aware of the Klan's activity in his congregation. He was a very young man, early 20s or so. And he went to a meeting of the Klan just to find out what they were up to. And by virtue of attending that meeting, he was told that he was now a member of the Ku Klux Klan. And so he was horrified by this. He went to the FBI and said, look, these people have been involved in beating black Christians. He'd actually seen these men with blood on their hands after visiting black churches and beating black Christians to a bloody pulp. And he approached the FBI and said, what should I do about this? They said, could you remain in the Ku Klux Klan and keep an eye on what's going on? Because some of these people are involved in an interstate conspiracy to commit acts of violence against American citizens. And so Delmar Dennis, who was a member of the John Birch Society, was approached by his coordinator, his field coordinator, told, you can't have anything to do with the Ku Klux Klan or any other subversive or violent organization and be a member of the John Birch Society. And Delmar Dennis had to take this individual into his confidence as to what he was doing in terms of exposing the criminal activities of the Klan. And in the matter of course, he was able to expose a number of violent crimes, including providing the key eyewitness testimony that solved the case of the Mississippi Burning murders. You may have seen that movie. You may have seen the movie that came out about 10 or 12 years ago called Ghosts of Mississippi, which had a somewhat caricatured depiction of Delmar Dennis. Didn't look anything like the rather unappealing actor they had playing him. But in any case, that was something Delmar Dennis did as part of his activism as a member of the John Birch Society, just fighting the Ku Klux Klan and everything that that collectivist organization represented.
So really was a defense of the Bill of Rights as a list of restrictions against federal power,
exactly,
as opposed
right.
to a grant of power to the national government against the states. Is that right?
Yeah. We're defending the Bill of Rights, defending the constitutional assignment of powers, and trying to rein in a renegade court before it metastasized into what we see today. That was the entire purpose of the campaign against Earl Warren.
Okay, good. I'm glad we got had a chance to let you go ahead and get that out of the way. Because I think there's a common misperception. When you say John Birch Society, people tend to think, immediately they think very conservative, and they would probably tend to maybe broad brush the racism angle in there, but I've seen your picture, and you're not lily white.
No, I'm not white by any description. I'm a large brown individual. It's really interesting. In the immediate aftermath of September 11th, I was under the rather freighted necessity of doing a speaking tour in the northeastern United States. That meant, of course, I had to fly. And on more than one occasion, I was singled out for special scrutiny because everybody expected that I was a large person of Arab abstraction. When I attended a conference in 1997, right after getting married to my wife, Corinne, who's a petite blonde, blue-eyed, blonde-haired woman, fair-skinned, a number of people I was hobnobbing with were from the Balkans. They looked at me and they figured that I was some Saudi prince who'd married a child bride. It's, you know, common misunderstanding. The point I'm making here is that the John Birch Society is, perhaps more than any other organization I can think of, completely indifferent to matters of melanin content. We have people who are not only at my end of the spectrum in terms of our physiognomy, but we have people from many different races and many different religious backgrounds united behind two propositions, the first of which is that freedom is worth defending through the means that we have at our disposal, meaning the Constitution, which has to be enforced through the citizenry, given that it is a restriction on what government can do. And secondly, that there are people who are trying to undermine our liberties, people who are interested in absorbing total power, not only over our country, but ultimately over the world, and that the best way to fight those people is to make our system work peacefully through educational means and activism.
I have to say, right after September 11th, I was kind of holding my breath to see what's the New American Magazine going to say, because, you know, you guys are first and foremost American patriots, and there's so much in the air and in the media, I guess, in the popular psychology at the time that patriotism means support for the warfare state. And I saw your first issue was strictly dedicated to heroic rescuers and so forth on that day. And then your second issue went straight to the topic of how best to deal with this problem. And I was very pleased to see that you guys did not support the Bush administration's policy of ending states that looked funny at near a terrorist one time.
Yeah, that, by the way, is something I really appreciate that you refresh our memory with respect to what we said in the immediate aftermath of September 11th. My concern, and the concern of many of my associates here at the New American Magazine and at the John Birch Society, was that what we have seen happen was what would happen, namely that we would see, rather than a focused effort to deal with a discrete foreign enemy and a specific threat, that the Bush administration would claim an open-ended mandate to make war against anybody they're choosing for any reason, which is why one of the first things we did after September 11th was to say that if the Bush administration had specific evidence about a specific foreign threat and a specific state sponsor, it should go to Congress and ask for a declaration of war in order to avoid what we see right now, which is an open-ended grant of power which the president is using to do pretty much anything he pleases, whether it entails making war against Iraq, a country that never threatened us, that never attacked us, that never posed a plausible threat to the United States, that had no discernible connection to what happened on September 11th, whether it entails looking at Syria and Iran as potential other targets, other theaters of operations, whether it involves imprisoning people pretty much without being charged or without any judicial review or scrutiny of the president's declaration, dispensing with habeas corpus in the process. All these things are part of a theory of warfare which holds that the president has pretty much a limited power to do anything he pleases to do in the name, supposedly, of fighting terrorism. We saw that coming. We tried to do our best to preempt it, to warn people about the possibility that we would see our country being turned into a garrison state on a permanent war footing. And liberty, as James Madison warned centuries ago, cannot long endure in a country that is in a permanent state of war.
Mr. Grigg, are you being naive about the dangers of Islamo-fascism? I'm trying my best here.
That's difficult to say with a straight face, I'm certain. I do not subscribe to the notion that the Islamic radical enemy, which is customarily referred to as Islamo-fascist by the neoconservatives and their fellow travelers, is in a position to do us significant damage. I do not believe they represent an existential threat to the United States. Certainly, Saddam Hussein's rattle-trap regime in Iraq did not pose an existential threat. Some of the demented things that coursed down the lips of George W. Bush in the build-up to war left me utterly astonished. He actually said that if we did not go to war against Iraq, that Saddam Hussein would have Americans at his mercy. This is a fellow who didn't control his own territory at the time. This is a fellow who had a fifth-rate army in 1991. It had been attrited for almost 15 years in the aftermath of the first Gulf War, 12 years, I guess it was, more than a dozen years in any case. Somebody who had a third-world economy, landlocked, no army, no navy, no air force to speak of. Somebody who didn't have freedom of movement in his own neighborhood, and supposedly he threatened the United States. But through the miracle of mass war psychosis, people were led to believe that Saddam Hussein somehow had the power to threaten the most powerful nation on earth, in spite of the fact that he didn't even pose a threat to his neighbors. And you could roll back the tape to January of 2001 when Colin Powell said on television, and I quote, "He threatens not the United States," close quote. Colin Powell speaking to Saddam Hussein.
Right, that was Rice and Powell both said that early in 2001, right?
Yep.
Hey, everybody, I'm Scott Horton. It's the Weekend Interview Show, and I'm talking with William Norman Grigg from the New American Magazine, the John Birch Society. We'll be right back after this break. Friends, welcome back to the Weekend Interview Show. I'm Scott Horton, and I'm talking with Will Grigg from the New American Magazine. I want to know what you think of this, Will. From The Guardian, March 21st, 2003, by Richard Pearl. Thank God for the death of the UN. Saddam Hussein's reign of terror is about to end. He will go quickly, but not alone. In parting irony, he will take the UN down with him. Well, not the whole UN. The good works part will survive. The low-risk peacekeeping bureaucracies will remain. The chatterbox on the Hudson will continue to bleat. What will die is the fantasy of the UN as the foundation of a new world order. As we sift the debris, it will be important to preserve, the better to understand, the intellectual wreckage of the liberal conceit of safety through international law administered by international institutions. Mr. Grigg, how do you feel about agreeing so closely with this right-wing warmonger, Mr. Richard Pearl?
Well, I disagree, first of all, with the characterization of him as right-wing. He's somebody who's very much of the opinion that rather than having multilateralism and an international organization that would coordinate efforts involving war and peace and so forth, we should be working through a vastly expanded central government of the United States. That's pretty much a classic left-wing idea. You consolidate power and at the level of the nation state.
He is a Scoop Jackson Democrat.
Yeah,
right?
which is to say he's a Trotskyite. He's somebody whose perspective on matters of politics and permanent revolution is more closely akin to that of Leon Trotsky than the views of, say, Washington or Madison or Jefferson or people of that kidney. In any case, Mr. Pearl was being more than a little bit optimistic about the overdue demise of the United Nations. I certainly yield to nobody in my desire to see the United Nations collapse under the weight of its own absurdity. But it's a really curious approach to bringing about the death of the United Nations to fight a war for the stated purpose of enforcing United Nations Security Council resolutions, which is something that President Bush has said on at least 60 occasions as justification for the invasion of Iraq. We were simply carrying out the disarmament decrees that had been issued by the United Nations Security Council back in 1991, which is why he and the Republican apologists who defended the war said that it was not necessary to get a declaration of war from Congress. You can hear people such as Rush Limbaugh and even Sean Hannity and people of that ilk saying that unless we went to war against Iraq, the power and prestige of the United Nations would suffer, which puts them in a rather interesting position, does it not?
It would seem to. They sort of took the traditional conservative critique of the UN and turned it upside down.
That's exactly right. There is a growing movement on the part of some people in the kennel-fed conservative movement, to use Pat Buchanan's useful characterization, to create an alternative body, an alternative international forum that would either supplement the United Nations or eventually supplant it outright. There are people who are talking about creating some kind of consortium or global council of democracies that would include the United Nations, forgive me, the United States, Great Britain, a handful of former Soviet bloc countries who are now new Europe as opposed to old Europe, and Israel and perhaps Turkey and some other countries in that region of the world who were somewhat congenial to us right now. But this would be, once again, the idea of amalgamating power in a fashion that would detract from national sovereignty and certainly would undermine entirely the framework for constitutional independence that we established as part of our country and tradition. The United States was created in an act of secession from a globe-spanning empire. We understood that in order to protect our distinctive perspective and tradition of ordered liberty, we had to do something to assert the independence of the 13 robust constitutional republics that existed in embryonic form in 1775-1776. We eventually created a limited federal government system that was independent of the world, was designed to remain independent. And yet you see people like the Richard Perles of the world, and in their train, people like the Rush Limbaughs and Sean Hannitys of the world, talking about enforcing the United Nations decrees, calling for the disarmament through force of sovereign nations, and perhaps even creating supplemental organizations that would carry out more or less the same kind of work apart from the United Nations. And this has nothing at all to do with the American tradition of order, liberty, under law, and independence.
That when you talk about them creating sort of a new UN, I guess that doesn't include Russia and China's veto anymore.
That's the idea. Get away from the... And as a matter of fact, you can find statements that have been made by the Limbaugh-Hannity crowd talking about the supposed need to do away with the Security Council veto somehow, which, once again, is a really subversive idea, because if we're going to remain part of the United Nations and we dispense with the veto, that means by simple majority vote, we could find ourselves being severely compromised. And that's one reason why we should get out of the United Nations altogether. There's a movement afoot right now by a PR agency in California that calls itself an organization, Move America Forward. And this movement, supposed movement, is built on the idea of getting the United Nations out of the United States. You've probably seen the ads on CNN or on the Internet. It's really interesting. That's exactly the wrong half of the proposition to grasp. What the John Birch Society has been saying for over 40 years now is get us out of the United Nations and get the UN out of the United States. Simply relocating the headquarters of the UN would do us no good if we're still part of that organization.
Well, you know, I sort of like the idea of the UN if it was what they sold it as in the first place, which is, I think, the general understanding is, well, it's a place where the leaders of the different countries can get together and meet and hopefully talk things out rather than go to war over every little thing. But that's not really what it is.
No. And it is entirely worthwhile to get people to sit down and discuss their differences without resorting to bloodshed. But once again, that's not what the United Nations was created to do.
All right. It's a weekend interview show. I'm talking with Will Grigg from the John Birch Society. Everybody stay tuned. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Weekend Interview Show. I'm your host, Scott Horton. My website is weekendinterviewshow.com, and you can send an email there, scott@weekendinterviewshow.com or scott@antiwar.com. I just started writing for them. Written 3 columns so far. I think my 4th one will maybe be up Monday or Tuesday. And my guest this hour is William Norman Grigg from the John Birch Society, senior editor of the New American Magazine. Sir, in your article yesterday about Bush and Putin that you wrote for LouRockwell.com,
yes,
you said, quote, they made an oddly matched pair. One of them heads an increasingly authoritarian and lawless government that is pursuing a radical vision of global revolution rooted in the teachings of the Soviet Union's founders. The other is merely the president of the Russian Federation.
Indeed.
And this goes back to what you brought up a little while ago about Leon Trotsky and Richard Perle. What does Trotsky have to do with the Republican Party, sir? What are we talking about here?
Trotsky is somebody who had been seen quite correctly by Joseph Stalin as a threat to Stalin's control over the Soviet government in the aftermath of Lenin's death. He was seen as one of the contenders for the throne, contenders for the crown, and so Stalin had him dispatched in Mexico City by an assassin. But Trotsky created an international movement, the details of which I won't go, I will not discuss at length, that was based on the idea that rather than creating socialism in one country, which was Stalin's model, you should be propagating revolution worldwide, that the revolution would never be secure if it were limited to one country, because the forces of reaction would always militate against it. So it was necessary to propagate the revolution beyond the borders of the Soviet Union, not only by armed intervention directly, Trotsky being the creator of the Red Army, but also by promoting surrogate insurrections and movements to subvert and undermine existing governments. If you go back and read the Communist Manifesto, it was made very clear in that document that the fundamental precursor to full-fledged communist revolution was to win the war for democracy. And the people who infiltrated the Republican Party's ruling hierarchies in the 1970s, and we were talking, of course, about the Crystals, the Bedorises, people of the kidney of Richard Pearl and Wolfowitz, Mr. Wolfowitz, the Deputy Secretary of Defense, who's somebody who has spoken of Leon Trotsky. These are people who were whose backgrounds have to do with the intellectual ferment that is rooted in the teachings of Leon Trotsky. And I contend, and a number of other people who are far better versed about the subject than I, that they have transposed the idiom of American politics into a Trotskyite key. When they start talking about global revolutions for democracy and using not only military intervention but also the intelligence agencies to cultivate insurrections against established governments in the Middle East and elsewhere, they're speaking the language of Trotsky. They're not speaking the language of Madison or of Jefferson. They want to take the old wineskins, if you will, of the concepts of Madisonian and Jeffersonian government and fill it with Trotskyite content. The other thing I pointed out in that essay was that the ruling philosophy of the Bush regime is rooted in Lenin's dictum that the scientific dictatorship of government is nothing less than this, power without limit, resting directly on force. And since September of 2001, the Bush administration has claimed an unlimited right to do anything the president and his advisors see fit to do in the name of defending the Rodina. Forgive me, that's the Russian expression, defending the homeland. And I see that there's a lot more continuity between the Bush administration's perspective on government and cultivating global revolution and that of the Soviet Union than the heritage that most conservatives would try to claim, which is that of our founding fathers, which is independence, national independence, honorable commerce with all, peaceful relations where possible, warfare only to defend our sovereign territory and the rights of our citizens, and limited government under the Constitution. The Bush administration has nothing to do with that heritage that conservatives should be trying to protect, and it's much more of a piece with the perspective, I think, of Trotsky and Lenin and their heirs.
Well, you know, it could be argued that we've been off the track that you describe as the right one since Hamilton created his first central bank, or you can pick your other favorite period in American history where we really started descending into empire. But do you think that the current crop of neoconservative policymakers have really kind of seized the government away from the traditional foreign policy establishment? It seems like with the purging of Colin Powell and Brent Scowcroft, that the neocons are, well, do you see them as part of the mainstream foreign policy establishment, and it's just maybe a different flavor of the same game, or is this really a new turn of events in American politics?
In all candor, I've not really been able to wrap my mind around that proposition so as to be able to parse it in any responsible way.
Because if anybody knows, it's you.
in my mind,
I think of the question in terms of, is David Rockefeller upset that the neocons are running things, or has he allowed them to do this because this is all part of the longer-term strategy?
David Rockefeller's big objective right now, and it's something that he actually said in a televised exchange with Dick Cheney a couple of years ago, is to create the free trade area of the Americas, which would be a European Union style amalgamation of the 34 nations of the Western Hemisphere except for Cuba. That's David Rockefeller's big issue right now. The Rockefeller family has been pushing that for decades. And it seems to me that everything else that's going on with respect to the so-called war on terrorism, the global democratic revolution, certain upheavals that are going on in the established corridors of international power, I don't know that Rockefeller really at this stage, this late stage in his life, is all that directly involved in this. But what I do know is that these people that we're talking about, the Richard Pearls of the world, the Wolfowitzes of the world, the Irving Kristols and so forth, they're part of the same gang. They all have writs in the Council on Foreign Relations. They're all part of the same constellation of think tanks in Washington and in New York City. They are, as you properly said, I think, sort of a different flavor of the same gang. There may be something of a Tong War brewing within the Eastern establishment, and right now there may be a certain clique that is in the ascendancy that's more of the flavor of the Condoleezza Rice and less the flavor of Colin Powell. But the point I'm making here is that all these alternatives, no matter which one we choose, will take us further away from what we should aspire to, which is to get back on the track that we discussed just a minute or two ago. Granted, there are ample examples in our history where our government has transgressed the limits of its power. Way back in the early 19th century or even before that, you can find where there are things that were going on that were not in harmony with the constitutional principles of our country. So one reason the Founding Fathers wrote a constitution, they knew that they couldn't be trusted with power themselves. It's a remarkable thing in human history, a group of men writing a constitution to limit what they could do, knowing something about their own fallibility. The problem now, of course, is you got people like George W. Bush who seem to believe that they partake of the divine nature, and there are people who look at George W. Bush as if he were an adjunct member of the Trinity, for heaven's sake. These people have no concept of their own fallibility. They're utterly convinced of their own benevolence. No matter what they do, no matter what crimes they commit against our institutions or against the peace of the world, and the invasion and occupation of Iraq is a world historic crime against our Constitution and against the Iraqi people, these people who arrange these hideous crimes are perfectly convinced of their own limitless benevolence. It's, once again, something completely out of character with the American concept of government.
And I think really all the evidence shows basically that what you say is correct in terms of the groupthink. Seymour Hersh says that if you don't drink the Kool-Aid, you're not allowed at the table.
Yeah,
the only people
so.
Making policy in the Pentagon are all ex-communists turned right-wing warmongers.
Yeah,
every one of them.
Karen Kwiatkowski has documented that very capably. She's talked about how people were being brought in to the inner sanctum of the Pentagon, who unmistakably have the reek about them of Trotskyite radicalism. And we come to a pretty pass, I grant, when a spokesman for the John Birch Society agrees with Seymour Hersh about a number of things. Seymour Hersh is a remarkably accomplished investigative journalist. I'll stipulate to the fact there are things we will disagree about, but his recent series of exposés about the way that the Pentagon is becoming this autonomous engine of global revolution should leave any American who cherishes our Constitution and cherishes ordered liberty astonished and frightened. And I really commend him for the work that he has been doing in the last couple of years, exposing the horrible mechanism that led to the abuses of Abu Ghraib, exposing what's going on at the Pentagon in terms of completely perverting the function of the military in our society and turning it into something that Leon Trotsky would be proud of, quite frankly.
And isn't it interesting? See, here's the part where we get back into things that maybe we can't know but sure are interesting to ponder again.
Yeah.
Is, you know, there was that old book, The Yankee Cowboy War, and is you sort of have the Republican Yankees that were the Nelson Rockefeller Republicans,
mm-hmm.
and the liberal Eastern establishment, as Quigley calls it, and all that. And
yeah.
then you had the kind of new right that grew up on basically government money, the Lockheed Martin Marietta Republicans,
yeah.
I guess I'd call them, like Cheney and Rumsfeld.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems like George Bush himself being the perfect mix of the Yankee and cowboy, that he would side more on the side of the Yankees, but it seems like the cowboys have really made this new alliance with the neocons, and the Yankees are sort of the odd man out.
And no matter which party wins, we lose.
That's right.
That's the really ironic thing.
And because they all really believe that the ends justify the means and the greater good is more important than the
exactly.
rights of the individual.
It's really a remarkable thing, by the way, that people perceive George W. Bush, the scion of an Eastern establishment family from Connecticut, as a cowboy. He's got a postage stamp Potemkin ranch that's basically a movie set in Texas.
That he bought during the campaign of 2000,
yeah.
by the way.
Yeah, it's a remarkable thing. People look at him as if he were the very dissolute masculinity. Good grief, Ann Coulter is more of a man than George W. Bush.
Ooh, ouch. Hey, okay, so then also you brought up the Seymour Hersh thing.
Yeah.
And this is actually my excuse for why it's been so long that I've been doing interviews on the radio and haven't yet interviewed you until today. And that is really because I was putting off for a day where I could arrange to interview you and Noam Chomsky at the same time. Because my mission in life, Mr. Grigg, is a new realignment. And it's just like the old anti-imperialist league in the days of Mark Twain. Yeah. I want to have William Norman Grigg and Noam Chomsky form a new realignment, say we can center it around the Ludwig von Mises Institute, and it will be the new anti-imperialist league. What do you say?
Well, a new anti-imperialist league is a wonderful idea, as long as the founding document and the articles of our faith are entirely defined by the Constitution. If we can all subscribe to that, I will align with anybody. I will partner with anybody in an effort to preserve our Constitution as it is written and as it is intended to be applied. And that begins with trying to reduce the malignant power of the badly overgrown executive branch and to stop these insane wars of foreign adventure that have nothing to do with protecting our country. So, yeah, that sounds like a very good idea, Scott.
Great. Well, thank you, because, I mean, it's something I really want to make happen. Now, I don't think Chomsky is going to go all the way and celebrate the Constitution, but I do know that more and more the quote-unquote progressive left are beginning to realize, surprise, surprise, in this age of Republicans, that, you know, federalism might not be such a bad idea after all.
Some of them are even reexamining the wisdom of secession. Some of the blue states, looking at what's going on politically, are beginning to wonder if maybe the Confederacy didn't have a point when they talked about the revocability of powers that have been granted conditionally to a central government. And as long as they're thinking in terms of reclaiming powers that have been delegated to the central government, then we have a common vocabulary, we can have a conversation.
Absolutely. And, you know, the federalism thing brings up medical pot, because George Bush promised to respect federalism and has done everything, of course, to betray that promise. And, in fact, I looked at the cover of the New York Times this morning, said that they're gearing up for a brand-new drug war in the Northwestern Corridor, because apparently all the good pot is grown up in Canada, not in Mexico.
Huh.
And I thought, you know, hey, maybe that's a good subject for Mr. John Birch Society, give you an opportunity to come out against the war on drugs.
Well, the war on drugs, like the war on poverty and the war on terrorism, is a complete fraud. What the federal government will do will be to declare war on something that cannot be defeated for the purpose of keeping the war going in perpetuity, in order to expand the power of government and constrict the available extent of individual liberties. I yield to nobody in my abhorrence of narcotics in any form. I try not even to take aspirin. And I'm somebody who can honestly say that I not only didn't inhale, but I didn't partake. That having been said, under the Federalist scheme, a state does have a constitutionally protected monopoly on dealing with the question of narcotics, whether it's used for medicinal purposes in California, for anything else. Go back and read Federalist Paper number 10. States have expansive powers, do all kinds of iniquitous things, James Madison said. I would consider permitting people to take narcotics to be iniquitous. But under the Federalist system, if California wants to have that system, living in Wisconsin as I do, I have no choice but to say that's their affair, and not to go to Washington, D.C. and say, I don't like the fact that California is permitting this. Why don't we use the tax monies of Californians and people from out throughout the union to try to suppress it? So as far as I'm concerned, the war on drugs has done far more damage than the personal consumption of narcotics could ever accomplish.
Well, you know, besides the subject of states reserved powers and the Tenth Amendment and that sort of thing, there's also the question of inalienable natural liberty, such as if I'm not infringing your rights, it's really none of your business, even if I want to shoot heroin into my neck, you know?
Well, once again, that's one of the reasons why we're supposed to have a federalist system, because people might have different perspectives on that natural right proposition. One thing that I think has to be added to the mix here is the fact that the federal government has been actively encouraging schools to distribute psychotropic drugs such as Ritalin for the purpose of behavioral control. So you have students in one classroom attending DARE meetings and being catechized about the evils of drug use, including the consumption of alcohol by their parents, and being taught to become good little Pavlik Morozovs, little informants for the state. They go to the next classroom, and they're receiving their Ritalin. It's the perfect illustration of the utter insanity of what's going on. And it's only insane if you assume that the purpose of government here, the objective of government, is to try to make our society function rationally. That's not the purpose. The purpose here is to acquire as much power over the government as possible through whatever means are necessary. And once again, the war on drugs has done a lot of damage in that respect. a lot of people don't appreciate the fact that the tragedy that took place 12 years ago in Waco, Texas, had its roots in the war on drugs, which made it possible to amalgamate military and law enforcement for the purpose of attacking that church at Mount Carmel. And it's just a really good example of how the war on drugs has been a solvent to break down some necessary barriers and inhibitions that were put in place by the founders for the specific purpose of avoiding what we see now, which is an increasingly centralized and militarized police state taking root in our country.
Well, thank you very much for that. I sure appreciate a conservative perspective opposing the war on drugs. Usually you basically hear it from a socialist who's going to say, yeah, they need to legalize it and pass it all out for free on and make the taxpayer pay for it.
Well, and tax it. I mean, the socialists are always looking for a way to increase the revenue stream to the central government.
Yeah, exactly.
I don't like that approach either, because I want to starve the central government.
All right, now let's get back to foreign policy here a little bit. Russia, that's the John Birch Society specialty, right? Everybody remembers their map of the world turning red. And I know you guys have been very suspicious about Russia for a while. The story was that they're working on convergence with the Russians. Now it seems like we're picking a new fight with them. So we'll be right back after this break to talk with William Norman Grigg about China and Russia and their relation with the United States. Stay tuned. It's the Weekend Interview Show. Show. I'm Scott Horton, and I'm talking with Will Grigg from the John Birch Society. He's the senior editor of the New American Magazine, and this is completely off topic to the question I'm about to ask, but I'm going to say right now that the reason that I'm such a big fan of the New American Magazine, although I do happen to disagree on some of the social issues and such, as I'm a libertarian, the New American Magazine gained my trust through William Jasper's coverage of the Oklahoma City bombing. It's absolutely unparalleled. You could read 5 or 6 or 10 books about it, and you wouldn't know as much as if you went to the subject index at thenewamerican.com and read through William Jasper's articles about Oklahoma City. And
God, I really appreciate that.
Absolutely not one time that I can think of has he had to say, well, you know, it kind of looks like we had that wrong, and it turned out it was really this. No, not one time did he leap to conclusions. Nothing but the facts, all the way from the first issue after the bombing happened all the way through right now. And I give the John Birch Society much credit for your coverage of that story.
Thank you so much.
Okay, now Russia and China. Now, well, we might not even have time to do China, but Russia. Now,
yes.
The deal is you're the John Birch Society guy, and nobody likes international communism. At the end of the Cold War, I know you guys were real suspicious that maybe they were kind of just faking us out and trying to get us to disarm and that kind of thing. And I'm not a big fan of the idea of convergence and you know, inviting Russia into NATO and creating a world state of the North. However, it seems like the neoconservatives and George Bush have been doing nothing but poke their finger in Vladimir Putin's chest, and it seems like they're doing everything they can to provoke a Cold War.
It seems to me that they've been rather schizoid, because on the one hand, you see the Bush administration making noises about Putin's admittedly heavy-handed rule, the fact that he is amalgamating, consolidating power, amassing power in his person, creating a cult of personality, which is a rather remarkable achievement given that he's an utterly drab and colorless and dour individual. And he is a representative of the security organs. He's a Czechist, to use the expression that a lot of people from the former Soviet Union use to refer to people who have a KGB background. The people who are running former Soviet Union are products of the security organs and the military complex, which is a bad deal for the Russian people. That does not necessarily mean that they are an active threat to the United States. The Birch Society's perspective has always been that if we had not gone out of our way to underwrite through technology transfers and aid and trade and credit the perpetuation of the Soviet Union, it would have collapsed a long time before 1989.
Well, but in that sense, weren't you guys on the side of the neocons during the 70s when when the neoconservatives through Rumsfeld and Cheney were working to undermine detente?
Well, they were trying to undermine detente in the sense of creating a more active state of confrontation with the Soviet Union. What the Birch Society said is that we should tend to our own garden, as it were, protect ourselves from potential aggression from the Soviet Union and satellites, but stop providing them with aid, trade, and credit, and not maintain a posture of permanent belligerence on the assumption that if we managed our own foreign policy intelligently and with an eye toward our own national independence, that eventually the Soviet government would collapse. Robert Welch was saying that as early as 1952, before he created the John Birch Society.
Right, and of course that's true, and of course they only say now that it was big government in America that defeated the Soviet Union, not
exactly.
The contradictions
of their
economy.
We defeated them by becoming like them, is the neocon line. We have to become like them in order to defeat them, and that's not our perspective at all.
Absolutely. All right, thank you so much for coming on the show today, sir. I really appreciate it. Hope we can do it again.
God bless.
William Norman Grigg, he's the senior editor of the New American Magazine. Stay tuned. We'll be talking with Linda Schrock-Taylor about why you need to get your kids out of government school. It's a weekend interview show. Stay tuned.